Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks, Matt. When I was asked to come and present today, I was challenged to start my presentation with a story rather than an introduction, so I'm going to do that. On the slide behind me, you see a picture from a recent Weight Watchers campaign featuring Alicia Dixon. Now, Weight Watchers are a national institution, a multi-million pound company. They spend a lot of money on research, all sorts of different types of research. Interestingly, for a company like Weight Watchers, they spend a lot of money on clinical effectiveness data. And Weight Watchers is proven to be a clinically effective service. They're regularly commissioned by PCTs, and that's probably one of the driving factors for why they have spent so much on clinical effectiveness data. But also, they really, really care about their service users, and much of their service design and innovation is led by the people that they serve and their core customers. Now, I was working on a project recently for the Department of Health looking at how you maximise the appeal of weight management services, and Weight Watchers was very much at the core of the brief. What is it that Weight Watchers do that makes weight management services, that makes their weight management services appealing? And I spoke to the chief exec, Audrey O'Brien. She's a lovely lady, and she helped me find out a lot about what they do to maximise the appeal of their services. And one of the things that was really evident, and actually you can, it's gone forward one slide, but actually one of the things that was really evident is that they really care about the people that they look after. And I know that's something that's mirrored very much in the GP presentations that we've heard earlier and people in the audience today. But when we were thinking about it, it really emerged that there was a core problem with the Weight Watchers service. And a clue is actually in the photo, and you probably have seen it because it skipped forward through a slide. And it's not Alicia Dixon. She's looking fabulous there in her pink skinny jeans. And it's not all the lovely ladies. And it's not the fact that if any of you've been to Weight Watchers, you'll know that they make more money selling brownies than they do in running their services. It's the fact that they only target a small number of the people who have who are obese. They're very, very good with the people that like them and the people that they target, but they're not good with a wide range of people. I spoke to Audrey, the chief exec, about this matter, and she told me that I asked her how effective the Weight Watchers service was with men, and she said, of course, it's as effective with men as it is with everybody else. And I realised I asked her the wrong question. The question I should have asked was, how appealing is the service with men? And I asked her, I challenged her to find me a male service user of Weight Watchers that I could speak to understand how he had gotten to the point where he'd been going to Weight Watchers. And it took them over a month to find me one. And they struggled, and he didn't actually want to speak to me. They only managed to find one in the whole of the Weight Watchers service. And what's interesting here is that as an organisation, they're regularly commissioned as the only weight management provider in a whole area. So that means that effectively either a whole population group or a whole group of people are either forced to go to Weight Watchers services and engage in a way that they feel uncomfortable with, or they just don't go at all, meaning that they're effectively excluded from the support, that the kind of quality of support that Weight Watchers offer. And this is no criticism of Weight Watchers. They do very, very well with the people that they work with, and they're absolutely fantastic. And as I mentioned, they have clinical effectiveness data to prove that their service works. So at that moment, I went on a bit of a mission to try and find services that appealed with a wider range of target audiences. In particular, I was trying to find services that appealed with men. And to be honest, the picture was somewhat bleak. I found a service. It was held in a car park. There was no Alicia Dixon, no brownies. It was freezing cold. It was a Friday evening. It was 8 o'clock. It was in Hull. But it was oversubscribed. They had more than they'd put more than 400 men through this service. They couldn't deal with the demand. And in contrast to the millions of pounds that Weight Watchers spend on marketing and advertising research, this service was set up by a guy called Rob Ward. He was an ordinary guy based in Hull, and he recognised, had seen this need that men were not being serviced by weight management providers. And he he identified a solution. Now, if we turn this camera picture around to the right, I wish I hadn't. I didn't have the foresight at the time to take a picture that was over the way. But you see that this service is actually in the car park of KC Stadium, which, as you might know, is Hull City Football Ground Football Club. It's very cheap to run. They don't use any of the Hull City Football Ground services. They don't have to buy into the venue. And for these men, the service being offered was very simple and meant that they had no stigma in attending a weight management service. The service is called FitFans, and we're going to hear a bit about branding later. And actually, no mention of weight, no mention of losing weight, no mention of dieting, although the actual service model was very, very similar to that Weight Watchers offered. The point of that story is that you don't need to have a huge research budget to come up with a great idea. At the time I met FitFans, they didn't have any clinical effectiveness data. They do now. They saw a problem, and they knew the audience that they had the problem with wasn't going to, and the services that were being offered didn't meet the needs that they had. They did some rudimentary research themselves. They asked the men why they didn't want to go to these services, and they set something up as cheaply as they could. So if there's one thing I want to communicate today, it's the power of insight. It's not just about powerhouses like Weight Watchers. It's about being able to identify common sense solutions to difficult problems, being able to move the problems forward. And importantly, I would like to leave you with one challenge to all the GPs and health practitioners in the room, and that's to try and see a problem from a different perspective. That's something that we can all do. And the method that I specialise in is a method called ethnography. You've heard it mentioned a lot today. It's not accessible to everybody to be able to commission a research agency to do this kind of work, but being able to borrow some of the tools that we use is absolutely open to all. So, and I'll explain a little bit more about how to do that later. And I should say, I'm not going to touch in my presentation on recruitment or any of the practical challenges in engaging service users, but I'm very, very happy for anyone to contact me at any point, and my contact details are at the end if they want support or help in that. I'm really passionate about people engaging members of the public, so if you do have specific questions, then feel free to get in touch with me. In the main part of my presentation, I just wanted to quickly tell you about a case study of a project that we worked on with the Design Council, and it perhaps is a subject that is relevant to some of you London GPs, and it's about violence and aggression towards staff in healthcare environments. Actually, the case study is about A&E, but hopefully there'll be some transferable insights there. It goes without saying that violence and aggression towards staff in A&E is unacceptable, and actually it happens way too much. 55,000 recorded incidents across the NHS last year, estimated to cost over £100 million, and current measures were often perceived to be ineffective. Assaults, when they do happen, are very, very serious. But I should say here that that slide should more accurately say when they are remembered. Assaults when they are remembered are very serious. And actually, our research showed that when the solutions that were put in place were often reactive or very literal. So they were focusing on these remembered very serious incidents, and they were focusing on kind of addressing those very, very serious incidents. So, for example, the putting police into A&E departments, which is now very commonplace across London, putting permanent security presence in security in A&E departments on Friday and Saturday nights, installing CCTV cameras, putting real big divisions between reception staff and patients. And if you listen to what the staff said in isolation about these very serious incidents, and this is not to undermine the staff contribution, one of the things I would recommend is to listen to staff. There are absolute wealth of insight and common sense about what patients need. But if you listen to what people were able to remember about assaults, these are exactly the sorts of solutions that would be most obvious to install. Of course, if staff are threatened with knives, we need police officers on hand. If people are going to jump over the reception desk, then you need to have a barrier to stop them doing that. However, the reality of the issue was much more complex. And actually, when we charted back through and actually looked to see how common these big assaults were, actually they weren't that common. Serious assaults did not happen very often, but they were talked about with greater frequency. Often the obvious security measures that were put in place weren't effective, and they sometimes even escalated the patients' feeling. They felt very divided. The barriers meant that patients had to shout at receptionists. Receptionists shouted back at the patients. Just because of the environmental design, it was escalating and causing people to behave in a more aggressive manner. And that's not, and it was also incredibly expensive, the measures that were being put in place. We did an extensive piece of work, including 300 hours in A&E departments at the most busy times of A&E in some of the most violent hospitals. And what we discovered that was that, and actually I should say, all of these materials are on the Design Council website, so I'm not going to talk through all of the details. There's a huge amount of more information there, so I'd totally recommend going there if you experience similar problems to this. But what we found was that the staff would talk about antisocial people as being the main culprits, drunk people, antisocial people, but actually when we documented in a systematic way the different kinds of perpetrators, we found that the majority of perpetrators were actually frustrated, ordinary patients, and mean you, anyone who came into the department. And the triggers for their frustration and their aggression towards staff were the inhospitality of the environment, as Colm alluded to earlier, just the fact that it wasn't a pleasant place to spend time. A clash of people, I think, as Colm also mentioned, different people coming together, being forced at a moment when they're in an extremely anxious state to spend time together. A perceived inefficiency of staff, and this was one of the findings that staff in the NHS that we were working with found the most difficult to accept. The fact that patients were looking at the process and thinking, oh my God, they don't know what they're doing. I can give you one example. The signs everywhere saying, please, staff, wash your hands. If you're sitting looking at that for 4 hours, thinking, oh, if the staff need to be reminded to wash their hands, what else do they need to be reminded of? All going round and round in people's brains. And at one moment, if a staff was, any member of staff was rude in any way to a patient, that could trigger them just to lose it. So this kind of perception of an antisocial person, this perception of a drunk person, was actually, it was right in some ways, but it didn't reflect the volume of experience and the volume of problem that was in A&E. And our research highlighted that the majority of hostility towards staff was caused by poor customer experience. And this insight led to the Design Council and Pearson Lloyd working in partnership to come up with a range of improvements to the customer experience, including environmental signage and a training program for staff to address this difficult issue. So by doing the research and thinking about it in a different way, we were able to move away from the very literal head-on security measures and restraint systems and barriers to thinking about how we could improve the customer experience and intervene early, preventing those incidents from escalating. So people-centered research. The four steps, I can't go into the detail of it, but again, I said I'm happy to answer any questions. The first part starts with defining the problem. The second is to identify the desired outcomes you want to achieve. What is it you're aiming for? Rob Ward from FitFans knew very clearly that he wanted to aim for a service that engaged over 40-year-old men, and he was clear in how he wanted to do that, so he was clearly targeting. He mapping behaviours, understanding what people actually do rather than what they say they do. Is it this a receptionist, or is it reported behaviour that you're interested in, or is it actual behaviour? And the final point is to identify the insights that can enable you to change what you do. And my challenge is that earlier we heard that this one of the things about today is to encourage the amateur innovator, and I'm really keen that there's an absolute benefit in ethnography, and I think one of the easiest ways to understand it is via the TV programme Secret Millionaire and the Undercover Boss. I mean, I know not everyone in the room can be the Secret Millionaire, but everyone can be the Undercover Boss if they want. You don't have to dress up like you're working in a chicken shop or anything like that. And what this would do is to, what I mean by this is to take some time to try and see your environment from a different perspective. Go and spend some time with the receptionist. Sit in the waiting room. Think about what the people experience and try to take yourself away from your own perspective and put yourself in somebody else's shoes. It's a fantastic opportunity, and we heard earlier it's difficult to find the space to think in as a GP, and if you can find 2 hours to do this, it's a fantastic opportunity to think and reflect on what's actually happening in your practice. So So that's all from me, and then my contact details at the bottom if you...
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.